It was June 2007 when a cocaine dealer from Romford, East London, phoned the man that was running his drugs line and asked him to meet at a local spot. The drug runner, whose name was Mark Tredinnick, agreed.
So Mark Tredinnick took his girlfriend and his four-year-old son to Benskins Lane to meet with Tony.
That's Julie Major, a neighbour who knew the men from when she was at school.
I'm like a Rottweiler. When I get older, Sank, I'm not letting it go.
The rumour was that Mark had got himself into debt while selling drugs for Tony and that the young men had fallen into a dispute.
Just out to save themselves, really. They were young boys.
But what Mark didn't know as he arrived at Benskins Lane to meet Tony was that there was a masked gunman waiting for him at the scene.
As he got out of the van, someone came out from the bush and shot him. And he died, unfortunately. He didn't die at the scene, he died, I think, 3 hours after he got to the hospital.
And he was shot in front of his girlfriend.
And his four-year-old son, unfortunately. But yeah, that was it was sad, you know, for his four-year-old son to have witnessed that, and his girlfriend. That must have been horrific.
Three men went down for the murder of Mark Tredinnick. The first was Tony Osborne, the cocaine dealer who had lured Mark to the scene. The second was Wayne Collins, who shot and killed him. And the third was a man called Ozzy, who was sat in a prison cell while all of this took place.
It's impossible to be ringing to involve yourself in something you have no foreknowledge of. That just, unless you're psychic, that can't happen.
We're taught to believe that our justice system is fair, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, and that it's almost impossible for an innocent person to go to prison for a crime they didn't commit. Because the alternative is just too awful to imagine. These are the stories of people who maintain their innocence and yet remain in prison, fighting unimaginable odds to win justice in a system that, many would say, is rigged against them. This podcast tells the stories of those on the outside fighting to free those on the inside. I'm Marnie Duke, and this is The Overturn.
My name is Julie Major. I've known Ozzy for... I knew him when he was very young. I used to live in the flat upstairs to his mum and dad. Then we lost...
Julie lived in a working-class area of Romford, East London, where she says none of the families had a lot of money.
My life at that time, I was 16, just got married to a man I'd only met 6 weeks previously. I did that to get away from home. I didn't get on with my stepdad. Things were really difficult at home, but that was a very stormy marriage. There was a lot of violence. He was one of the nicest men you could meet, but if he had a drink, he was violent. So that was a very stormy relationship. So it was a bit like out of the frying pan into the fire. At that time. And the attitude to domestic violence back in the 80s is different to what it is now. I remember one time we had a fight. I went over to the phone box. I called the police. I had a split lip, busted nose. The police come down, very young policeman, never forget it. And he said to me, either go back indoors where you belong or I'll take your baby away. So I had to go back home because that was the attitude. Then what went on indoors was private between a couple.
Julie says she was just 6 stone when that relationship ended. More than once, she sought refuge in a neighbour's flat. Eventually, Julie left that husband and moved, but she always kept in touch with the family who lived downstairs. She says she would often bump into Ozzy in the local area.
He was always very polite. Like, if he'd see me, he'd always come up, give me a hug, say, how are you? Ozzy had a brother called Tony. They grew up together when they were small. I'm not sure at what age they separated. The mum and dad separated when they was very young. But I know Tony chose to live with his dad. Ozzy said to me that though he wanted to live with his dad, he didn't want to leave his mum on his own, so he stayed with his mum. So they grew up quite separate. Tony was a very different personality. Tony was very quiet. What you see with Ozzy is what you got. You know, he was honest. He was very Their big personality, everybody liked him. Tony was very withdrawn, very quiet. I mean, he was always a little bit, I don't like saying this really, but he always come across as a little bit sneaky, Tony. So they sort of led separate lives, really. Ozzy had one set of friends, Tony had another set of friends. They did their, you know, lived their life separate. They talk, but not like a normal, what I'd call a normal brother relationship.
And Ozzy was getting into a little bit of trouble around his teenage years, is that right?
It never do you any harm, you know, and he was a really good person. As he got older, Ozzy got a bit angrier and got in a bit of fighting, more with bouncers, doormen when he went out drinking. It was more when he had a drink. Yeah, he was quite known to the police. They didn't like him. I mean, back in the day, yeah, when Ozzy was young, it was a lot different. If police didn't like you, they'd want you off the streets. It was a lot easier for them to bend rules.
And what about Tony? What?
Tony actually, on the face of it, led a respectable life. He did an electrician's course. I think he had his own business at one stage. So on the surface, he led a very straight life. At the two of them, you would have said Ozzy was the bad one, Tony was the good one. But as I say, that's very surface, because Ozzy was very open with the way he was. Tony was a bit more sly with the way he was, is the best way I can put it.
So what was going on behind the scenes then?
Well, Tony was dealing drugs. And I mean, at the court case, it was the police said they could find no intelligence that proved Ozzy was dealing drugs with Tony, but that was the accusation at court, that they was both dealing drugs together.
In June 2007, when the murder took place, Ozzy was in prison. He was just 22 years old.
So Ozzy was in jail. He was in jail, I think he'd been in jail for 4 years, for GBH without intent. So it was accepted in the court that though he didn't cause the problem, he'd obviously caused some harm. He'd had a fight with some doorman in a nightclub. I think his sentence was due to finish pretty around the time that this offence took place.
So could you take me through what happened on the day of the crime?
Well, I'll actually take you back to the day before the crime, simply because it's quite significant to Ozzy's case. The day before the murder took place, Tony actually tried to get Mark Tredinnick to the murder scene the night before.
Mark Tredinnick, that's the man that was running the drugs line for Tony's cocaine selling business. Julie says the pair had fallen out over money.
And Mark Tredinnick was actually at a barbecue, so he said, I can't come tonight, I will meet you tomorrow. So the next day, Mark Tredinnick took his girlfriend and his four-year-old son to Benskins Lane to meet with Tony. As he got out of the van, someone came out from the bush and shot him. And he died, unfortunately. He didn't die at the scene. He died, I think, 3 hours after he got to the hospital. So a masked gunman came out of the bush as he got out. As he approached the van, someone shot him.
He was shot in front of his girlfriend.
And his four-year-old son, unfortunately. It was sad, you know, for his four-year-old son to have witnessed that, and his girlfriend. That must have been horrific, you know. So that's what happened. Tony was arrested first. A burnt out car from the scene was found where Tony lived. Also, as the police, I think, arrested Tony, he threw a chip onto the floor of his vehicle, which was recovered, which showed liaisons between him and Wayne Collins. Wayne Collins is the person that did the shooting.
Not long after, Ozzy was implicated in the crime too. The day after the shooting, the man that he had shared his prison cell with approached a prison officer and said,
my cellmate knows something about a murder. So they then contacted the outside police. So when he first spoke to the police, the witness said that he had heard Ozzy and Tony on the phone arranging the murder.
The phone records actually disproved this. Ozzy had had no contact with his brother Tony for a month prior to the shooting. However, the night before the murder, Ozzy had called Wayne Collins, the gunman who had shot and killed Mark Tredinnick. Julie argues that this is complete coincidence. She says, as there had been no previous contact between the men, it is therefore impossible that Ozzy could have had knowledge of the men's plans.
Wayne and Tony were obviously in touch for a couple of weeks before the shooting, because phone records show that. So they got in touch with each other themselves. Ozzy couldn't have introduced them because he had no contact with either. The only contact Ozzy had with Tony or Wayne was the night before the murder. He phoned Wayne and had a 7-minute phone call with him, in which the courts have said Ozzy arranged the murder. However, like I mentioned earlier, they'd already tried to get the witness to the scene the day before, and he had refused to go because he was at a barbecue. So when Ozzy rang the night before the murder at 10 p.m. at night, he had no foreknowledge that Wayne and Tony had been in touch with each other. He had no foreknowledge that they'd tried to get the victim to the scene earlier that day. So how can you be ringing to involve yourself in something or arrange something that you have no foreknowledge of?
So why was he in contact with Wayne Collins that night?
They knew each other. They were friends. He actually called Wayne just off the, on the off chance. That's what he said, his biggest regret, if he had not phoned him. And, you know, he actually spoke to, Wayne was in the pub and he spoke to several of his friends. So Wayne passed the phone round the pub. And Ozzy spoke to quite a few of his friends. I think in one statement, the cellmate witness actually says, oh, they was just talking about girls and stuff. So it's never been, he never said he heard. And he's in the cell next to him. He never said he heard Ozzy arrange anything. And like I said to you, Tony and Wayne had obviously already started making arrangements because they'd been meeting up. They tried to get the victim to the scene. They tried to get the victim to the scene, I think, at 5 p.m. that night. Ozzy didn't ring Wayne till 10 o'clock that night. So, and he had no foreknowledge of events. So, you know, it's impossible to be ringing to involve yourself in something you have no foreknowledge of. That just, unless you're psychic, that can't happen.
And that phone call took place on the illegal phone?
Yes.
Okay, so there would have been no way of hearing that phone call back, I suppose, as you could have done on a prison phone?
Yes, no, there's not, no. But as I say, it was only 7 minutes. And I don't mean it rude. Mark was 26 at the time. No 26-year-old is going to have the power to click their fingers and arrange a murder in 7 minutes. You know, you've got to be pretty powerful to be able to ring it, do one 7-minute phone call in a month and say, OK, I want this to happen, and it happens.
Julie says that on the day of the murder, Ozzy received a call from a friend via an illegal phone telling him that Mark Tredinnick had been shot. It's at this point that his cellmate approached the prison officers to hand over information. While he had initially said that he'd overheard Ozzy and Tony plotting the murder, he then changed his story, saying he'd overheard Ozzy on the phone to the gunman, Wayne Collins.
He just said that the shooter rang Ozzy and said, I've stuck 10 in him.
Meaning?
Yeah, like 10 bullets, yeah. So
only six cartridges were found at the scene of the crime and one live bullet.
The gun expert that looked at the shrapnel from the body and the scene said in his opinion only six shots were fired. But the prosecution very much, they said there was 9 track wounds in the victim's body. They said that with the 9 track wounds and the one live, that made 10.
The track wounds that Julie refers to are the paths left by bullets inside of the body. Mark Tredinnick had 9 of these, plus the one live cartridge. The prosecution argued that this made 10, which matched the cellmate's testimony.
He just said that the shooter rang Ozzy and said, I've stuck 10 in him. So that put truth into the witness's statement. However, as I say, there was only 6 found at the scene, 1 live, and the gun expert said, in his opinion, only 6 were fired. The victim's girlfriend, in her statement at the scene, said she heard about 6 shots. So in reality, there was no 10. And 9 track wounds, like, I don't like talking about things, but 9 track wounds in a body, if you're aware, when a bullet enters a body, it ricochets if it hits bone. So you can have entry and exit wounds. So the track wounds can be a bullet ricocheting backwards and forward. So 9 track wounds doesn't indicate 9 bullets at all.
Why do you think the cellmate would have been so specific when giving a number, though?
Well, the gun was a machine gun, and unless you'd have to go and count that to see how many bullets were fired, you know? And as I say, there was only 6 shells found at the scene. So really, and the girlfriend said only 6, the gun expert said only 6. So it sounds like that 10 was wrong. And I think that's just a phrase he probably had picked up along the way. And I don't know why. It's only specific because the evidence was sort of fitted to that 10 by the courts and the prosecution, really, by saying 9 track wounds and 1 life makes 10. And really, that's false representation.
What do we know about the cellmate?
The cellmate was a Somalian. He had 13 aliases, 9 different dates of birth. Even the Home Office papers, which I have, state that they did not know his true identity. He had a string of violent convictions, including armed convictions. As I say, every time he got arrested, he gave a different date of birth, a different name. He was constantly lying, constantly, you know, just lying about anything and everything. He
changed his story. On the 27th of May, just days before Mark Tredinnick was shot and murdered, Ozzy's cellmate had received a letter saying that he was facing deportation back to Somalia.
Because he acted as a witness in this case, the police intervened in his deportation and said that his deportation couldn't happen because he was a vital witness. They supplied him with canteen, like for cigarettes, for food and stuff whilst he was in prison. Once he came out of prison, they bought him clothes, put him in a hotel room, gave him money. But the main thing was his deportation was stopped because obviously he did not want to go back to Somalia.
Julie believes that this was his motivation for snitching on Ozzy, that he fabricated the story in order to avoid deportation. When the case got to trial, Tony Osborne and Wayne Collins, once accomplices in the murder of Mark Tredinnick, turned on each other as neither wanted to go to prison.
Tony and Wayne went cutthroat, so they turned on each other at the trial. Ozzy didn't get up and speak at all at the trial on advice from his team. And they just out to save themselves, really. They were young boys.
Tony pleaded not guilty, denying involvement in the murder. This meant that he was unable to advocate for his brother Ozzy's innocence without implicating himself in the crime. As a result, the testimony given by Ozzy's cellmate was accepted and never cross-examined.
The thing is, Tony couldn't have took Ozzy out of the picture and said the truth, like it wasn't Ozzy, unless he was admitting his own guilt. And he wasn't going to admit his own guilt because he was looking at life imprisonment. So he could not have cleared Ozzy without admitting that he had done it. And there was no way he was going to do that because he didn't want to go down for life.
So Tony implicated his own brother in order to save himself.
Yeah. Yes, unfortunately he did.
When Julie first heard about Ozzy's case, she was studying for a law degree.
Do you know what? I've always wanted to do a law degree all my life. And years ago when I was young, law was financially, you couldn't do that. And someone like me, working class, it wasn't available to do it. It was only really available to if you was a bit more well off. And I got a brain aneurysm 6 years ago now, 2018. And I had a 5-hour brain op. And I just decided, life's too short. I want to do what I've always wanted to do. And I want to show my children and my grandchildren, it doesn't matter how old you are, you can achieve what you want to achieve. So I just decided to go for it.
She saw a petition online and decided to get back in touch with Ozzy, who sent her the details of his case.
And when I started reading it, I thought, this is wrong. You know, there's so much wrong with this case. What the hell was going on? And I just decided to take it on and start fighting, really, for it.
That's when Julie began to dig, sifting through the case and looking for grounds for appeal. By then, Ozzy had been in prison for 12 years. Sentenced to life in 2009 with a minimum of 30 years, he'd given up hope. His mum had written to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, or CCRC, to request an appeal. But without legal training, she hadn't made the right kind of arguments. Julie decided to contact them herself, but they confused her with Ozzy's mother and told her the appeal had already been considered and was unsuccessful.
So when they responded and gave me a flat no, they actually cited her points from her application, not mine. They got the two muddled up. So I said to them, I said, and they said, well, we're not opening it. It's closed. It's done. So I thought, I'm not having this because this is disgusting. You've muddled two applications up. That's not correct. So I went through the back door. I raised the complaints through the complaints at CCRC. And I said, you know, you've got two applications wrong. This is disgusting. While I was putting that complaint in, I raised points that I believed were wrong with the case. And they come back and said, we're going to reopen it and give you a new caseworker.
While she was working on a new application, Julie was contacted by the witness, Ozzy's former cellmate, who was now back in Somalia and admitted to fabricating his testimony. He said he wanted to put things right.
So at first he said, oh, what he wanted to help. We thought, great, he's going to help. He's going to finally tell the truth.
In return for denying his previous statement, the witness was demanding that Julie pay him £30,000.
And I said to him, I cannot give you any money because if I give you any money, it will make your statement null and void because I've paid you. So we can't give you any money. He then said to us, can we just pay his legal fees, which was, I think, £150. So I contacted the CCRC and I said, would you be happy if we paid his legal fees, would that jeopardise anything in any way? And he said, as long as, you know, you think it's a solicitor, you care, it's okay. Like he went and the CCRC caseworker asked his bosses and he come back and said, yes. So I got an independent solicitor to look up the address. He said, it looks kosher. So we sent, with permission from the CCRC, we sent him £150.
Julie arranged a date and time for the witness to speak to the CCRC. In order to provide his testimony.
They was aware that a pivotal witness in this case was calling them because I had to give them a time and date. So when the witness called them, they failed to record the conversation, which to me defies belief. Absolutely. Why would you not record that? You know, you have the ability. Why would you not? And he told them that he'd made a mistake in his evidence and he'd said something that wasn't true, but he behaved very erratically. So anyway, they said we could pay the £150. We paid it to him. He then contacted us and said, I don't want to go ahead with it. I'm scared I'll get arrested if I go back to England. And he disappeared. And the CCRC said that he was not reliable in what he was saying to them, which again defies belief to me because he wasn't reliable when he gave evidence that sentenced a man to 30 years. He committed perjury on the stand. He changed his statements many a time. His behaviour was erratic. So how was it okay for him to be unreliable but sentence a man to 30 years, but it's not okay for him to be unreliable to get that conviction overturned? You know, you can't have whatever way it suits you, it's got to be the same either way. So that actually sort of stunned me a little bit.
The CCRC rejected Julie's application to overturn Ozzy's conviction.
And as I say, I would not have done it without the CCRC's say-so. And yet in their response, they said I appear to have collaborated with a witness, but I only did it with their permission. I asked first, and if they had said no, that you know, you can't do that because it would some way impinge on what he was saying, I wouldn't have done it. I didn't do anything without their say-so. So it then really annoyed me that they came back and said I appeared to be collaborating.
It's not only the witness who has withdrawn their initial testimony in recent years. Ozzy's brother Tony has since admitted his guilt, confessing that he implicated Ozzy in the crime by pleading not guilty at trial.
He's now said he did do it. Well, he actually said that he hired Wayne to frighten Mark Trudinic. He actually hired him to frighten him and it went wrong. And he said, like, I said to him, I mean, I've got a covert recording. And I said to him in that recording, all right, and if was Mark anything to do? He said, no. I said, but did he know something about it? Because I needed to know. And he said, no, he knew, excuse my language, F all about it. He said he had nothing to do with it. He said, I contacted Wayne. I arranged it. Wayne went there. It went wrong. Wayne called me and told me it went wrong. He said, and then my life just went wrong from there and has since. And as I say, it's a Section 9 legal statement taken by an independent solicitor, nothing to do with me or anybody else. But the CCRC believe that the appeal court won't accept that information. So, you know, Tony gave the plausible reason that the reason he didn't do that trial because he was just trying to save himself. He had a small child. He didn't want to go away for life. So he was out to save himself. But, you know, he said it's bothered him since. But I think it's took Tony a long time to come to terms with everything. You know, he was young. They was all young, you know. And I think it's only now as an adult, he's fully grown adult, he's probably realising what he actually did to his brother.
Do they have a relationship now?
No. No. Ozzy was 22, I think, when he went to jail. He was 26 when he got convicted for this crime. And he's now 42, nearly 43. Yeah. So he's got no children. You know, there's moments he can never get those moments back that he's lost. And he said he feels like he's been kidnapped and shut in a box. And he suffers quite, he gets quite anxious, gets depression. Sometimes you don't hear from him for weeks because he's struggling. He's doing really well in jail now. He's a listener in jail. He's got a gym job, like a gym trainer job. He's sort of turned, at first he rebelled against the system when he first went in there, you know, when he first got convicted for this, because he's like, I didn't do this. What are you doing to me? You know, 30 years. But now he still fights it, you know, and he still, you know, obviously maintains his innocence. He's working with the system as well, rather than against it. We talk on the phone a lot. Yeah, we're in regular contact. You know, for example, when I lost my grandson, yeah, Ozzy rung me up. He said, I said some news about the CCRC, and he said, forget the CCRC, let's deal with what you're going through first. So he's a very caring person. He made mistakes when he was young. He wasn't an angel, you know, but Ozzy says, I've more than served my time for the things I did wrong then. But, you know, he's not a murderer. He didn't murder anybody. He shouldn't be in there for murder.
Am I right in saying you haven't had a lot of support in your campaign?
No, not really. It's just been me. Yeah, as you see, it's been a bit of a... Yeah, it's just been me, really. And it's been difficult. It's a bit soul-destroying doing something like this because every corner you turn, it's a battle. Most media doesn't want to know unless you're on the winning side. They don't want to know unless you've been referred. But we don't need your help then. We need your help now. You know, they should be helping us to fight. Same as the post office. Look at the post office people. The media crucified them at the time. As soon as they won their case, the media wanted to make programs. They wanted to report. That's not when you need their help. It's now. Now you need. So it's been really difficult running a full-time job, family commitments, doing my law degree and helping Ozzy has been just... Yeah, it's just been one bit. And it's hard when you're on your own doing it because you just think, like, it's just hard. It's just so much work involved behind the scenes. As I say, contacting people, producing paperwork, trying to find paperwork. And there's more closed doors or doors slammed in your face than there are doors opened.
And how hopeful are you that you will be able to overturn?
Well, I've always said, because I'm like a Rottweiler, when I get older, saying I'm not letting it go. And I said, I won't ever give up. So I've always said, I believe I will get it referred because I believe there's so much wrong with this case. It can't not go to the appeal court. And sometimes it's small bits in a case that become the big, most important bits, but they don't have time. And if they can't see them, they don't want to know. So people just languishing in jail with nobody to help them and nobody that wants to listen to them. There's many a people that are in jail that should be there, but there are also a lot of people that shouldn't. And some of them people have got no family, no money, and they're just forgotten, and that's sad. Because, you know, if me or you was put in jail for something, it could happen to me tomorrow, it could happen to you.
At 19 years old, Mark Ozzy Osborne was sent to prison for getting into a fight with a club doorman. At 26, he was convicted of murder under joint enterprise for a shooting that took place while he was inside. The key witness tying him to the crime has since recanted his statement. His brother Tony has also confessed his guilt and said that Ozzy played no part in the crime. Ozzy has spent his entire 20s and 30s in prison for a crime he says he didn't commit. Judy, however, is not backing down. There is a new solicitor looking at the case and a CCRC caseworker reviewing the application for appeal. But for now, Ozzy remains in prison, looking at another 14 years behind bars. In the next episode, I look at the case of a man sentenced to a minimum of 19 years under joint enterprise for a stabbing that he didn't do.
I don't understand, and I don't think I'll ever understand how something so insignificant would set those wheels in motion.
This series is a production of the Future Justice Project. It's produced and presented by me, Marnie Duke. Executive producers are John Robbins and Callum McRae.